Lone Pine, February 2nd, 1971. The thought has come to me that it might be well to have a seminar on the subject of death in the psychical meaning of the term. Death has two aspects. One is the ceasing of function on the part of the physical organism and its subsequent decay. But man is not only a physical entity, he is also a psychical being. And what death may mean in the psychical sense is a matter of far greater importance than what it means in a purely physical sense. We generally assume that the process of death is beyond any control of him who is dying. However, there are sources that say quite otherwise. In the Tibetan Book of the Dead, edited by Evans Wentz, in certain of the footnotes, it is asserted that death can be a conscious process and that it can in considerable measure be an art. This was further enforced by the introductory remarks from Lord Woodruff. He, who under the pseudonym of Arthur Avalon, contributed so much to our understanding of the Indian Tantra. Indeed, it may not be always true that the dying individual can do anything about the process. In fact, that may be only exceptionally possible. Nonetheless, if possible, it would make a considerable difference from all that we can learn if one directed his psychical awareness and power in appropriate directions rather than letting the process take care of itself. But before entering into this subject, there is another consideration that is of considerable importance. This is related to the conception of a psychosomatic unity. Is the psyche and the soma or body separable? There are differences of opinion upon this subject, and if as one assumes the position taken by certain writers, such as Aristotle and Dr. Walton, it would appear that the psyche and the soma are not separate and not separable. If this is true, then the fall of the body would mark the fall of the psyche and the continuation of consciousness in any sense beyond death would become very questionable. This has a considerable pertinence for us. First, for those who are oriented to homeopathy. Hahnemann promulgated the conception of a soma-psyche interconnection and implied that the healing of an individual is not only a physical process, but is also a psychical process. It is said that he derived this conception from the reading of De Anima, written by Aristotle. Now there is little or no doubt that there is an interaction between the soma and the psyche. But how rigid this interaction is, whether it implies radically that the fall of the body means the discontinuance of all consciousness, or, on the other hand, is a looser interconnection, so that in principle, while soma and psyche interact, yet they are in principle separable. And thus, the fall of the body, or the soma, does not of itself imply the fall or discontinuance of consciousness in some form. It has also importance in connection with the history of Christian theology. It may well be that the Christian view that man has but one body, namely this gross animal body with which we are all familiar, and the continuation of consciousness beyond death, is dependent upon a literal, physical resurrection of that body. An event supposedly becoming possible only with the resurrection of the Christ after he had perished upon the cross. The Oriental view on this subject is very different, and so was the view of Plato. Plato held that the body was a habitation, and that the inhabitant, the real being, could occupy that body and could depart from it when the habitation fell and go on in a field of consciousness beyond. So also are the teachings very explicitly on this point by Sri Aurobindo. The implication runs all through the religious philosophy of the Vedanta and of Buddhism, that there is something which continues, something which lives a course that is determined by a law of karma. And indeed it is implied that in a profound sense, consciousness is not destroyable. I follow this latter position based upon my own experiences and my acceptance of these Oriental philosophies. And therefore, death in the psychic sense is something very different in its meaning from death in the physical sense. In other words, it is a change of form or state of consciousness, not the destruction of consciousness per se. To bring this subject before our attention in a more tangible and realistic form, I will give a report of certain testimonies which I have received from individuals who have gone through the process of death part way, but were unable to make the full grade. There was a case of a man whom I knew formerly, who was, as he claimed, a Christian Scientist, but one who at the same time was a thinker in his own right, and not a mere repeater of the writings of Mrs. Eddy. He told me of a time when a friend of his was being treated for tooth problems by a dentist. And at one point ceased to breathe. Now my friend happened to be present. And he proceeded to talk to this individual, urging him to come back, and kept on talking and talking until finally the man's body began to breathe and the man then protested against this annoyance of having to listen to a voice when he was in the most comfortable and delightful state in space. Note the fact that the individual came back to embodied existence reluctantly, that he reported enjoying the state in which he was very much indeed, and that he seemed to be in space of some sort. Another instance was given to me another friend who went through such an experience himself. He was a neighbor and was an automobile mechanic by profession. Once, while in Oregon, during a cold period, he lost consciousness through the action of becoming far too cold. And then, he said, he found himself in space in a most desirable state. Later, before it was too late, his body was found, and it was brought back to life, much to his annoyance. He says that he knows not what death is, and there is nothing to it. The third testimony of such an experience was given to me by a Russian aristocrat. This was a person of more than usual parts, and whose name I shall not mention, since he would be known. But he belonged to the descendants of the family that ruled Russia for 158 years. He was of Tartar extraction. He was not only by birth an aristocrat, but in fact one of the aristoi in his own right. He told me that he had read 3/4 of his father's library by the age of 7. He was a captain in the Russian army at the age of 16. And this was not merely due to the preferential treatment that a member of the aristocratic class might receive, for he actually contributed means for the reduction of the loss of life that was being imposed by the German army in the First World War under the leadership of von Hindenburg, who had managed to lead the Russian invaders into certain swamps. He was very high in aristocratic circles, was admitted to the secret archives of the government for 1 month, and he told me that he entered those archives as an idealist, as one with faith in human nature, and came out completely disillusioned concerning the action of man as representing the different governments of the world. Though the account that I'm about to give grows out of a serious, nearly mortal wound which he received during military action, he told me that he was lying upon a bed, that the surgeons did not find him strong enough to operate, and he thought, and apparently they thought, that he was dying. He said an aunt of his was present, and he asked her to take down notes of the process of death, since he himself felt that he was dying. And thus there could be a record of the process as far as he could speak. He said he was proceeding in this way when all of a sudden he found himself again in space and in a state of exalted delight. But in this case, he decided that it was not right for him to depart, so he came back voluntarily, thereby revealing that he was more than an ordinary man. And he manifested in his body such increase of vitality that the surgeons judged it possible to operate and did so, and he recovered. Note, in each of these cases, there is a reference to a being in space in a state of extraordinary delight, which was greater than any of the desire to live in a physical body. The next two cases are taken from literature. One report is in an insert that I once had, which was taken from a medical journal, being the substance of a lecture he had given to the graduating students of a medical school in Edinburgh. Among other things, he told of this experience. He was lying on bed after eating a meal and had a severe case of indigestion, which resulted even in his heart stopping its normal beat and fibrillating, as it was later determined. But he found his consciousness, or consciousness principle, as it were, in space above the city. He found that there was with him, though unseen, a mentor, so that questions which arose in his mind were answered by this mentor. It is not clear whether the answer came as sound as though it were sound heard outside, or simply as something in his own consciousness. He saw the city before him, and thus, therefore, was stationed in space. But over the city was spread, as it were, a psychical net, which consisted of lines moving at angles, probably right angles to each other, and that at each crossing was a knot, and that knot represented individuals in the city. It implied that any action in the psychical sense of any one individual had influence across these lines, greater in the case of those who were near, but still extending outward and diminishing with force only gradually. He could see also the objective city below him. He could see inside the dwellings, and this could see the streets. He saw then, his landlady, come to his door, knock upon it, and then enter. Then depart to a telephone, and so at a distance someone answer the telephone, who then collected a bag and came as rapidly as possible to the place where he was dwelling. And then, as was later determined, gave to him an injection with camphor in it and drew him back in body consciousness, much to his regret and distaste. I notice again, there was delight in the state in which he found himself, and a sense of being in space, but in this case, with more knowledge of an environment of some kind. The next case is also taken from literature. This is the experience of Dr. Carl G. Jung. I shall read a portion of this account. It is to be found in the book entitled Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, and is part of Chapter 10 entitled Visions. At the beginning of 1944, I broke my foot, and this misadventure was followed by a heart attack. In a state of unconsciousness, I experienced deliriums and visions, which must have begun when I hung on the edge of death and was being given oxygen and camphor injections. The images were so tremendous that I myself witnessed that I was close to death. My nurse afterward told me, it was as if you were surrounded by a bright glow. That was a phenomenon she had sometimes observed in the dying, she asked. I reached the uttermost limit and do not know whether I was in a dream. At any rate, extremely strange things began to happen to me. It seemed to me that I was high up in space. Far below, I saw the globe of the earth, bathed in a gloriously blue sea. I saw the deep blue sea and the continent. Far below my feet lay Ceylon, and in the distance ahead of me, the subcontinent of India. My field of vision did not include the whole earth, but its global shape was plainly distinguished, and its outline shone with a silvery gleam through that wonderful blue light. In many places the globe seemed colored or spotted, dark green, like oxidized silver. Far away to the left lay a broad expanse, the reddish yellow desert of Arabia. It was as though the silver of the earth had there assumed a reddish gold. Then came the Red Sea, and far, far back, as if in the upper left of a map, I could just make out the pit of the Mediterranean. My gaze was directed chiefly toward that. Everything else appeared indistinct. I could also see the snow covered in mine. But in that direction, it was foggy, flight. I did not look to the right at all. I knew that I was on the point of departing from the earth. Later, I discovered how high in space one would have to be to have so extensive a view, approximately 1,000 miles. The sight of the earth from this height was the most glorious thing I had ever seen. After contemplating it for a while, I turned around. I'd been standing with my back to the Indian Ocean, as it were, and my face to the north. Then it seemed to me that I made a turn to the south. Something new entered my field of vision. A short distance away, I saw in space a tremendous dark block of stone, like a meteor. It was about the size of my house, or even bigger. It was floating in space, and I myself was floating in space. I had seen similar stones on the coast of the Gulf of Bengal. They were blocks of tawny granite, and some of them had been hollowed out into temples. My stone was one such granitic dark block. An entrance led into a small antechamber. To the right of the entrance, a black window sat silently in lotus posture on a stone bench. He wore a white gown, and I knew that he expected me. Two steps led up to this antechamber, and inside, on the left, was the gate to the temple. Innumerable tiny niches, each with a saucer-like platter, filled with coconut oil and small burning wood, surrounded the door with a wreath of bright flame. I once actually seen this when I visited the temple of the Holy Tomb at Kandy in Ceylon. The gate had been framed by several rows of burning olives out of this site. As I approached the steps leading up to the entrance, a strange thing. I had the feeling that everything was being slowed away. Everything I aimed at, or wished for, or thought. The whole phantasmagoria of earthly existence fell away, or was stripped from me, an extreme dangerous. Nevertheless, something in me, it was as if I now carried along with me everything I had ever experienced or done, everything that had happened around me. I might also say it was with me, and I was with me. I consisted of all that, so to speak. I consisted of my own history, and I felt with great certainty this is what I am. I am responsible for what they did and what has been accomplished. This experience gave me a feeling of extreme respect, but at the same time, a great importance. There was no longer anything I loved or desired. I existed in an objective life. I was what I had been. At first, the sense of annihilation predominated, of having been stripped of purpose. But suddenly, that became of no consequence. Everything seemed to be in me was the only without any reference back to what had been. There was no longer any regret that something had got all had been taken from me. And that under years I had everything that I wanted, and that was everything. Something else engaged me. As I approached the temple, I had the certainty that I was about to enter an illuminated room, and would meet there all those people to whom I belonged in the end. There I would at last understand. This too is a certainty. What historical nexus I, for my life, could have been to. I would know what had been before me, why I had come into being, and where my life was going. My life, as I lived it, had often seemed to me like a story that has no beginning and no end. I had the feeling that I was a historical figure, a picture for which the preceding and succeeding text was missing. My life seemed to have slipped out of a long chain of events, and many questions of the meaning were answered. Why had it taken this book? Why had I brought these particular assumptions with me? What had I made of it? I felt sure that I would receive an answer to all these questions as soon as I entered the rock. There I would learn why everything had been done and not had been done. There I would meet the people who knew the answer to the question about what had been before and what would come after. Here we have a particularly comprehensive account of an exceedingly interesting and valuable experience. The text goes on to say that there appeared a disturbance far down to the left, and that an entity appeared who proved to be his attending physician. And this entity said to him that he brought a message from the people of Earth asking Dr. Young to return. And as a result of that, Dr. Young woke up, so it is stated, in his body, and then spent a considerable time in bed, having a continuation of certain remarkable experiences, but finally becoming well enough to continue with work he still had to do. And in fact, said that he thereafter wrote some of his most valuable books. Now, other items of particular interest here. One thing that stands out is that the view of the earth is dominated by the color blue. This same quality is reported by the astronauts as they look back at the Earth. It therefore suggests that the vision was objective. It would suggest that the space, if not actually the same space in which we commonly live, was nonetheless a some sort of cold space that gave perception in objective terms akin to our perspective of observation with which we are commonly familiar. Another feature of particular importance is the report of the painful exfoliation, an experience in which it is stated that everything that Dr. Young has, the memory and the possession of his experiences and thoughts and so forth, were stripped away from him, and that it was a very disagreeable process. But then it appeared that after having been stripped, he found that he had with him all that he had been, all that he had experienced, in evidently a different sense. For now, he was identical with his experience, with his own history, and not simply one possessing as an object of consciousness. This is a point of very great interest in me, for it fits something which is stated in the Theosophical literature, that after death, in the ordinary sense, there follows, sooner or later, a second death in which there is stripped away that which one has acquired in the life, and such as is worth retaining is taken up into another a level of consciousness and there assimilated. I won't go into the technical part of this, but all of the students are familiar with it. But it is interesting as bearing out this point. It is stated in that literature that those items that are of only transitory are only mundane in their bearing, are stripped away and remain stripped away. Whereas those items of experience and thought which have a spiritual value, a value that is more permanent in the light of the enduring entity, and are taken up and become a part of a higher level of consciousness. This would seem to explain the reason why the state of wealth following the state of poverty was as though the entity was identical with this content of consciousness, that it was not simply an external possession. He was identical with his own history. It was therefore more than a memory. This account of Dr. Young is one of the most interesting statements that we have to us of the rest. It has a special importance, inasmuch as it is the testimony of a qualified, articulate Western mind speaking to Western mass in the restrained language of the science. Whereas so much that we have from the Orient is doctored up with flowery speech and well-nigh impossible figures that leave us guessing as to what is real and what is fancy. A fact that makes much of those materials that come from oriental sources of limited value to the more austere and factual Western mind. One other instance has come before my attention, but very recently, which marks a rather definite deviation from certain characteristics which are true of all the five instances reported so far. This individual had been in the German army at the age of 16 and had been wounded severely, and at one time thought he would die. He said the experience was one of panic terror. He said he had not been a praying man, but at that time he did start to pray, and then the experience was transformed into one of delight. This variation I find to be of a good deal of importance. It does imply that the experience of death, if one has not made a preparation for it, can be even one of panic terror. And that would indicate that it is a matter of premier importance that we should prepare ourselves for a transition, which it does not seem very probable that any of us can escape. We are far too inclined to focus our attention entirely upon the affairs of external life, leaving to nature or to the action of other entities, real or supposed, the handling of the problem of transition and making no preparation for it. It would appear to me that this is a very foolish course of action indeed, for we have every reason to believe that the span of an ordinary life, even though it were one of 100 years, is but a fleeting moment in the totality of the history of the individual. And the preparation for the transition to that other domain would well be a matter of the highest importance of every individual whatsoever, especially those who have reached and surpassed the tradition reads God and presence. Not forget that the Orientals have told us that preparation for death is important. That at least in some of us, it is possible to do something about it, insofar as it is a psychic event. There are three volumes, at least, that deal with this subject. One is a volume that was composed during the Middle Ages. Another is the relatively well-known Egyptian Book of the Dead. And finally, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. I am not really familiar with the first two, but I have studied the last. What the source of this volume is lost in certain uncertainty. The editors claim that it may be very ancient in its roots, perhaps even contemporary with the Egyptian Book of the Dead. But at any rate, it has been assimilated to Buddhistic thought, and it is stated that the steps that are here revealed have been verified by those who have had the power to go over the process in consciousness, pass through the physical process of death itself. The presentation here has much that has an alien sound to our ears. But it is pointed out that the pattern was oriented to the cultural and religious background of the Tibetan people, and that those who did not have that cultural and religious background would not have the same experience, but an experience conforming to that which was normal to them. At any rate, this much seems to be rather typical of the process as they're delineated. One could pass through the whole process consciously, but most typically he passes first through what is called a death swoon, from which he later awakens and may not even know then that he has left his gross physical body. But that later he does make the discovery that he is no longer in that body, but in something else that is subtle, something that could well correspond to what has been called the linga sharira, or astral body. That he can be aware at such time of the objective environment, of those who may be grieving because of his passing, and may be conscious of what may be done with those items which he had left, items of a material sort, that he may become indignant because things are used in a way that he does not regard as appropriate, that he may attempt to communicate but cannot produce any effect upon the consciousness of those who remain. This, bear in mind, is a picture of the ordinary death. It is not a picture of one who has attained something of yogic power. The feature in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which I find to be of supreme importance, is a statement recurring over and over again, which I have found nowhere else in either theosophical literature or the Buddhistic sutras or the Vedantic shastras. And that is that the deceased, immediately upon entering in to the state of the bardo, is presented with that which is called the clear light. First of all, in its highest form, and then gradually in descending forms of adequacy and purity, until such time as he may be reduced to the limited objective of seeking birth again, either in this world or in some other loka, of either a pleasant or unpleasant sort. This which is offered to him repeatedly is the call, the clear light, and acceptance of it, giving himself over to it in its first presentation, is said to be equivalent of entering into the Dharmakaya state, the highest possible state for a man to reach. And then later, at lower states identified with the Sambhoga Kaya. This would correspond to the states of consciousness of the highest forms of yoga. And the peculiar feature of the Tibetan Book of the Dead is that it states that it is offered as a possibility to everyone who enters the bardo, but that if the karma is unfavorable, if the candidate is not prepared, he will revolt, will be repelled by the clear light, and will seek to go otherwise. This is very interesting. It would imply the very highest possibility as the immediate event after death. I would translate clear light as pure consciousness. For it is traditional that light is a symbol of consciousness, and clarity has a meaning essentially that of purity. It is that which is unmade, unformed, uncreated, that which is the original stuff of which all that appears as form is produced. It is the one thing which is not merely an appearance or a mask, but which is absolutely real. That is the meaning conveyed. To accept this is to accept the highest possibility of consciousness. In fact, the highest possibility of yoga itself. And the remarkable fact is that if this text is true in fact, it is offered to all as an opportunity, even though they are not prepared to accept it. But there is a question that remains. Would one, in accepting the clear light or the pure consciousness, sever himself completely from all of the rest of humanity? Or would he accept and also retain a correlation with the processes in the manifested universe, or samsara, as it is called by the Buddhists? I consider the latter to be a real possibility, and that the ideal course would be to accept the highest possible, and then to contribute from that to those who have needs in this world or in other locus in the endless mass of inner possibilities.